Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ecclesiastes chapter 4 as we continue through Solomon's book. This chapter I will call Oppression, Toil, Friendlessness, Advancement are Meaningless. We start now in Ecclesiastes 4, verses 1 through 3. Solomon says, "Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun." Well, Solomon is very depressed about the human condition, and he expresses it very well, poetically. Basically, he's saying, "I wish I never had been born. Not that I wish I was dead, because if you had never been born, you wouldn't have had the chance to see all the garbage that's in this world. At least if you're dead, you don't get to see it anymore, but if you never existed, you wouldn't have gotten to see the evil in the first place." Now, Solomon says in verse 1, he looked again. He's already looked at all the oppression and evil on the earth. He says so in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 16. "Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness." Under the sun means in this life. Now in verse 2, Solomon congratulates the dead who are already dead. Now John Gill makes the point that he must be referring to the righteous dead. The dead who are not in the presence of God would have no need to be congratulated. They'd be in hell. So I guess we will assume that. Of course, Solomon, I'm not sure, really understood heaven and hell. He's just looking at it from his earthly point of view. I can imagine him thinking, "Well, I don't know what happens to dead people when they die, but it's better than having to stay around here and look at all the evil that's in the world." Now, this is a profane sentiment if it's severed from its context. If God and his ultimate judgment and deliverance were removed from the picture, yes, then it would be better to be already dead. But of course, there's some good news coming, that God is going to redeem all this evil. Solomon has just given us the bad news first. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about that. "Job, David, Jeremiah, Habakkuk all passed through the same perplexity until they went into the sanctuary and looked beyond the present to the judgment. Then they saw the need of delay before completely punishing the wicked to give space for repentance, or else for accumulation of wrath, and before completely rewarding the godly to give room for faith and perseverance in tribulation." Now, I don't know about you, but I wake up every morning thinking about all the evil in the world. I keep thinking, how in the world can God put up with all this garbage that's going on down here? This is especially relevant now as America has undergone a period of complete moral inversion where evil is good and good is evil. Well, I'm not the only one that's thought that way, and I know there's millions of other Christians that are thinking that way now, too. But this is a common sentiment amongst the saints. How about Job 3, verse 12? This is one of the five scriptures I'm going to read you showing people who are depressed because of evil in the world. Job 3, 12. Job says, "Why did the knees receive me, and why the breast that I should suck?" He was talking about his personal evil, but that was evil. And he says, "Well, why did I live? What's the point of being here?" Psalm 73:3, this is a psalm of Asaph. "For I envied the arrogant. I saw the prosperity of the wicked." There's a lot of wicked people that are very prosperous these days. It's depressing to see. Jeremiah 12:1. Jeremiah says, "You will be righteous, Lord, even if I bring a case against you. Yet I wish to contend with you. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why do all the treacherous live at ease?" It's a good question. It irritates me every time I think about it. It irritated Jeremiah. It irritated Asaph. It irritated Job. And speaking of Job, this is what he again says in Job 21, verse 7. "Why do the wicked continue to live, growing old and becoming powerful? Why do you allow this nonsense to go on, God?" Habakkuk says in chapter 1, verse 13, you're talking about God, "Your eyes are too pure to look on evil, and you cannot tolerate wrongdoing. So why do you tolerate those who are treacherous? Why are you silent while one who is wicked swallows up one who is more righteous?" Well, those are characters speaking in somewhat of a irritated, annoyed, maybe even desperate tone of voice when they consider evil in the world. But here are some scriptures showing trust in God despite the evil in the world. Asaph, whose psalm I just read, Psalm 73:3, sees the prosperity of the wicked, but then he drops down to verse 17 and says, until I entered God's sanctuary. Then I understood the wicked's destiny. They're going to get theirs. In other words, he just has to be a little patient. Habakkuk 2:20, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let everyone on earth be silent in his presence. Don't worry about the prosperous evil people in the world. God is in his temple. He's going to take care of it. Habakkuk says in chapter 3, verses 17 and 18, though the fig tree does not bud and there's no fruit on the vines, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will triumph in Yahweh. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. And of course, that's talking about calamity or poverty, temporal setbacks. Even in the midst of those, we're going to trust in God. Habakkuk is, but also when you have evil people prospering, we need to trust in God too. Psalm 92, verses 7 through 12 says this. The author of this psalm is unknown. He says this. Though the wicked sprout like grass and all evildoers flourish, they will be eternally destroyed. But you, Lord, are exalted forever. For indeed, Lord, your enemies will perish. All evildoers will be scattered. You have lifted up my horn like that of a wild ox. I have been anointed with oil. My eyes look down on my enemies. My ears hear evildoers when they attack me. The righteous thrive like a palm tree and grow like a cedar tree in Lebanon. So it's a human thing to worry about all the evil in the world, but it's a spiritual thing, a matter of faith to believe that God is going to judge all the evil in his own time. We just have to be patient. We might have to go through tribulation, but we need to know he will judge it. Evil will not ultimately triumph in this world. Now let's go off on a little rabbit trail here. Verse 3, which says, but better off than both of them, the live and the dead, is the one who has never existed. And some people use that to prove the preexistence of the souls. How, I don't know. I don't believe in the preexistence of the souls. And how somebody who believes in that would use that verse to prove it, I do not know, nor do I really care. We go now to Ecclesiastes 4, verses 4 through 5. Solomon continues, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Now verse 4 and verse 5 on the surface seem to contradict each other. In verse 4, Solomon is complaining about people who work all the time. In verse 5, he's talking about lazy people. Well, we'll reconcile that in a minute. First of all, notice that the person who is laboring, he's doing it in verse 4 because of rivalry between himself and his neighbor. We have an expression for that, keeping up with the Joneses. People are not working to excel for the sake of the work itself. Labor, of course, is a good thing if you enjoy your work. But if you're just trying to get more boats and a bigger patio and a bigger house so you can keep up with the people in your neighborhood, I mean, really, talk about vanity and striving after the wind, that is. Now, in verse 5, the fool folds his hands. That's because he's not going to work. So he folds his hands to either go to sleep or to stop working. Now, what Solomon is trying to do between verses 4 and 5 is show the foolishness of two extremes, as Ellicott and Benson say. In verse 4, he says it's vanity to try to sweat to keep up with the Joneses. And in verse 5, he says it's vanity and striving after the wind to not work at all. As the pulpit commentary suggests, it will not do to react against the folly of working too hard by being lazy. Two foolish extremes. Now, in verse 5, the lazy man consumes his own flesh. How is that? Well, he could be starved for want of food. He's not working, so he doesn't have any money, so he can't buy any food, and his body eats itself up. Or it could be, as he's sitting around being lazy, looking at everybody else, thinking, well, everybody else has material goods, and I don't, and so I'm envious of that, and so his spirit gets eaten up. Well, I think Solomon was saying he consumes his own flesh because he's not working, because he doesn't have any material goods to feed himself with. We go down to Ecclesiastes 4, verse 6. Solomon continues, one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. Now these, in my opinion, are probably the words of Solomon. He's saying that it's ridiculous to work so hard to get wealthy if you don't rest and don't take time to enjoy what you're making. This book of Ecclesiastes is perfect for middle-class American Christians. It's just perfect because we are so tempted to strive and work to pile up material goods, but doing away with something fancy so that our wife can stay home and parent the kids? Well, no, we'd rather put work in our two fists and strive after the wind. It could be that Solomon here is quoting the words of a lazy fool, or not quoting the words, but referring to a lazy fool, and the fool would be saying this: one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. So the fool is saying, it's stupid to work, I'm just going to be lazy. I don't think that's what's happening here. I think that Solomon is not referring to the fool, but he's referring to the idea of working too hard. It's not a good idea. We go now to Ecclesiastes 4, verses 7 through 12. Then I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother. Yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. Now, to summarize these six verses, what Solomon is saying, you want to be a miser, a rich person who stays by himself and just makes money and that's all he cares about? It would be much better if you had a friend. And then he goes on to talk about how two are better than one. In other words, you and a friend would be better than you by yourself. So starting back in verse 7, Solomon says, then I looked again at vanity under the sun. The vanity he's looking at is the vanity of another fool, not the lazy fool that he just mentioned back in verse 5. This is the vanity of the fool who works too hard. He doesn't need to. He doesn't have any dependents. Verse 8, there was a certain man without a dependent, no son, no brother. He didn't have to take care of anybody, and yet he's working like a dog. No end to all of his labor. Why? He doesn't have dependents that are dependent on him. Why doesn't he just relax a little bit? Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches. In other words, he's made a lot, but he's not satisfied with all the riches he's made. He wants to make some more. And he's never asked, for whom am I laboring? He doesn't have any dependents. Is he working for himself? Well, he's depriving himself of pleasure as he works. For whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? Because when you work too hard, you don't take any time to smell the roses and enjoy life. How many people do you know like that? John Gill says of this rich, miserly fool that he might not have any dependents because he has deserted the dependents. Well, I don't know if that's true. That don't really make any difference. So verses 9 through 12 talk about how 3 is better than 2. It's pretty obvious. Verse 9, 2 are better than 1 because they have a good return for their labor. Think about when you're doing a handyman job around the house. My father, who was a construction person, he knew how to build things, but he always had me hang around to hand him the hammer, hand him the nails, just as another hand, or to gopher, to go get something. In other words, I had no skill. I was a stupid cement block, but it increased the return on his labor a good bit to have an extra hand. Verse 10, for if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. How many times do you have industrial accidents when somebody is by himself, working late at night, hurts himself, doesn't have anybody to help him? Woe to the one who falls when there's not another to lift him up. And verse 11, furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Ah, this reminds me of a time I was in the Atlanta airport. My wife and I were flying back from somewhere, and there was hurricanes everywhere. And the plane was grounded, not only our plane, but every other plane. The airport was filled up with people who couldn't fly out, and they had assigned people to the hotels in Atlanta, and the hotels were all filled up, and they said, so sorry, we can't put you in a hotel. And so I said, well, where are we going to sleep? And they said, on the floor in this room. I said, okay, I can live with that. I've been in worse situations in China. So my wife and I, well, I assumed my wife and I were going to lie down. We could keep warm. I didn't think it was going to be all that cold, but they didn't turn the air conditioner off. It was freezing in there, and my wife didn't want to take her contacts out because she was afraid she would lose them. And so I lie down on the floor by myself with summer clothes on and no blanket, and I am miserable. I'm freezing to death. And all of a sudden, I hear this feminine voice lying next to me. She's lying down there with her boyfriend. They're under a blanket, so warm and cozy. And she knew I was miserable, and she said, "Would you like to get under this blanket?" I said, "Oh, thank you, young lady, thank you." It was probably a little bit immodest, but when you're freezing to death, you don't worry about things like that, believe you me. So, again, one more example of how you need other people to help you get through this life. Verse 12, if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. Of course, two against one, you've got the odds. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. If you see wool wrapped around and try to pull it apart with your hands, you see the three strands that are twisted together. So these are very common, homely examples to show. Two is better than one. Or in the last example, three is better than two. We go now to Ecclesiastes 4, verses 13 through 16, and we will finish this chapter. Solomon continues, a poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. That's the poor lad came out of prison to become king. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. That means the young boy who was in prison replaces the old king, the old and foolish king. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him. Now the hymn there is the young, poor yet wise lad who becomes king in his father's place. People are not going to be happy with him either. For this too is vanity and striving after wind. Now Solomon could be thinking of this poor yet wise lad. He could have been thinking of his father David, who was poor and in exile before he took Saul's place. And Saul could have been the old and foolish king that Solomon is writing about here, because Saul was old and foolish. He did not know how to receive instruction. We see that in verse 15, everybody came to his side, thronged to the side of David, the second lad, the son of Saul, in other words. And he became king, but then it says that those who came later were not happy with him. That might refer to Absalom and the rebellion that almost destroyed the kingdom of Israel, all of which Solomon would be thoroughly familiar with. I'm not sure. This is just speculation. It could be that Solomon himself is thinking that he is the old and foolish king. So at any rate, what Solomon is trying to show is that people are not satisfied with their government. They just aren't, even with good governments. I mean, Winston Churchill, who single-handedly saved the world from Nazi tyranny, was voted out of office as soon as the war was over, World War II. Here's what Adam Clark says about this. A king who had abused the authority vested in him by oppressing the people had a son whose prudent conduct promised much comfort to the nation when he should come to the throne. The father, seeing the popular wish and becoming jealous of his son, shut him up in prison. In the interim, the old king either dies or is deposed, and the son is brought out of prison and placed on the throne. Then multitudes of the people flock to him and begin to walk under the son, i.e. the prosperous state to which the nation is raised by its redemption from the former tyranny. However, the wise man, that would be Solomon, the author of Ecclesiastes, insinuates that this sunshine will not last long. The young king, feeling the reins in his own hands and being surrounded by those whose interest it was to flatter in order to obtain and continue in court favor, he also becomes corrupted, so that those who come after shall have no cause of rejoicing in him. Now, if Solomon is thinking of himself as the old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction, then his son, to whom everyone thronged, would be his son Rehoboam. And then his son, who after a while no longer was respected by the people, that would be Rehoboam, because he caused the 10 northern tribes to split off from the nation of Israel because Rehoboam was foolish in the matter of taxing them too much. Now we have a little ambiguity in verse 16 we need to look at. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them. Now I assume that means before the old king and the young king, all the people who came before that are not happy. In other words, it's not just these two kings that people were unhappy with. They were unhappy with all the kings that came before, which doesn't surprise me. Governments generally are oppressive. They're necessary, but they usually cause a lot of trouble. Bad government is much more common than good government. But that before could be taken in a spatial sense to all who were before in the sense that they were standing in front of before the old king and the young king. Everybody's not happy. Either way, the sense is not changed. For this too is vanity and striving after the wind, Solomon's favorite phrase here in this book at the very end of chapter 4, verse 16. What is vanity and striving after the wind? He's probably referring to being a king. It's vain to be a king. It is meaningless. It is futile to be a king because nobody's going to be happy with you. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Ecclesiastes 4. We are now ready to go to Ecclesiastes 5 in our next audio, which I will entitle Stand in Awe of God, Riches Are Meaningless. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.